Hi there. Welcome to Extra Innings, covering all the bases. My name is Albert Dabba, and I am the host of Extra Innings. On the podcast that we have been going now since January, we talk about many different kinds of subjects, but particularly about mental wellness, mental illness, and all kinds of maladies that people have, including bipolar disorder, anxiety disorder, suicide, subjects that people normally do not like to talk about or find that they're difficult to talk about. And I believe there is a stigma about mental illness and about people talking about themselves when they're having their troubles. We have had on many different kinds of guests, people who have written books. Like tonight, we have on a wonderful a woman who's written a book. Her name is Marissa Gerson, and the book is called Forget Prayers, Bring Cake. We'll get to her in a few minutes. We also have had on actors from a film that I made called Extra Innings, which basically reviews and kind of documents the real story, the true story of my life growing up in the 1960s in a home that had many kinds of issues and challenges to deal with. So after making the film, I decided to do a podcast about the film and about issues such as we're going to be talking about. We've had on poets, we've had on writers, doctors, therapists, and all have really given their best in terms of how to deal with some of these challenges that we deal with. So I have been also running a production company called Simba Productions for the past 41 years, doing all kinds of videos and films for all kinds of different clients and businesses. But Extra Innings, my feature film, my first feature film, was the first one that we actually are showing on our website, as well as on Amazon and about six other platforms. So now I'll introduce to you Marissa Gerson. Marissa, how are you today? Oh, I can't hear you.
I'm doing wonderful. Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Oh, thank you. Thanks. Marissa, we've talked a couple of times before this, and I have your book. I have not finished reading it, but it's a really wonderful, I've read about five chapters, and it's a wonderful beginning of a book to really get you started on how to deal with grief. And the way you have it laid it out in chapters, I think is wonderful. So I'd like to talk to you about that. You live in New Orleans, is that right?
Yeah, I'm in New Orleans right now.
So tell me something about New Orleans. Has a special place in my heart. I've been there a couple of times, and it gets on the news a lot for all different kinds of reasons. And you're not originally from New Orleans, is that right?
No, I'm from Washington, D.C., and I moved here in 2019. The beginning of my third year here now.
Okay. So what's it like there in New Orleans these days?
It feels a little bit like what it might feel like after the apocalypse and we all come back together and start over. Uh-huh. We've had a pretty horrific storm here, and some people probably don't notice too much. I mean, we still have a lot of debris in the streets, and we're still having some trouble with trash removal. But there's a lot of homes and communities and businesses that are currently still shut down, restaurants down the street that won't be opening for a while. I just today actually went to this remarkable museum called the Backwater Cultural Museum in the Treme, and it holds like a family that's preserved the history of Second Lines and Mardi Gras Indians, and a tree fell right on top of the museum. So we've been... I spent part of my day today in a U-Haul helping them take the contents of the museum to a storage unit to help preserve the history of New Orleans. And so it is precarious here right now, but the spirit is strong and the weather happens to be perfect today. And we're expecting a cold front, which we're all holding our breath for.
Yeah, I actually, now that I think about it, we showed the film Extra Innings before COVID started. We were showing Extra Innings in different festivals all around the country, including going to London once, and it will be shown in Australia coming up in, I think they delayed it because of COVID in March. But I always loved New Orleans. The couple of times I've been there, I found it a fun city to be. So what made you move from Washington to New Orleans?
Well, I've lived in probably 10 cities in between. I grew up, it's hard. My narrative isn't easy to follow. I grew up in DC, but I moved to New Orleans from Massachusetts, and I was living in a pretty rural part and wasn't finding enough access to different communities I was hoping for and academic opportunity. And I was ready for something exciting and for a change. And I fell in love with a house in New Orleans, and I was already in love with the city. So I moved here and took a pretty big risk, and a lot has followed in really wonderful ways.
Wow, great. Now, didn't you tell me, I believe you told me you lived in Martha's Vineyard. Is that right?
That's the community I always say in Massachusetts. Because when I say Martha's Vineyard to most people, they hear like, oh, the Kennedys and the summer and like the Inkwell and this like very populated scene. But I lived there only off season. So I always just say a rural part of Massachusetts because it saves me from filling in the blanks. But I was living there when the population swells by like 300% almost in the summer. And so the winter is very different. And I realized I needed more for what I was working on in my own life. So I came down here. And one of my topics of focus is inherited trauma. And New Orleans is a great teacher for someone like me who's interested in, what do we do with legacies of pain? And what do we do with legacies of injustice? And what do we do with legacies of slavery and of genocide and other things of the sort? What do we do with legacies of hurricanes like Katrina and community failure and city failures and things like that? So I've learned quite a bit living here. And the reason I wrote the book was because I moved here and a week later, my father grew ill with a rare brain disease. And so he died 2 months after I got here. But I did come here from Martha's Vineyard. I was living in a part of the island that's really very sparsely populated in the winter. And I dare any of you to do a full winter there. The only locals know the strength of the Martha's Vineyard winter. It's a little intense.
What part of the island did you live?
I was in Chilmark on the north side. Oh. The wind is really intense. And, depending on the winter, it's not so bad. But I happened to be there for some pretty icy, stormy nor'easter winters. And I got to New Orleans. And part of living in a beautiful island in the winter where there's not that many people is you form really close relationships. And it was hard to leave my community. It was hard. I knew everyone at the coffee shop every time I went. So it was hard to come here. I didn't know anyone. And then my dad got sick. And then my dad died 2 months later. And I was like kicking myself a little. I was like, I just took this giant leap into the unknown with very little support. And so this book is really about me calling on all of the things that I had learned over the years that helped get me through that period of my life where I didn't, I wasn't in a nest. I wasn't in like a warm, happy, like, comforting. I mean, I'm not sure any of us when death comes are like perfectly situated. But this was me figuring out how to get the support I needed when I was sort of a fish out of water.
Right. Right. Well, you, I heard about you from Nancy Arony, who lives all year round in Martha's Vineyard, who is a dear friend of mine. So it's funny because you never know who you're going to meet and how you're going to meet them. So it's nice to meet you. You just mentioned something that I never heard of before. You said inherited trauma, I believe. Is that what you said?
Yes. The inherited trauma is the focus of most of my research and my work before I moved here. And I'm not sure it's its own formal field, but in my life, it's the study of what happens to war, what happens to genocide, what happens to community violence, what happens to racism in the next generation. So I grew up in a family with a Holocaust legacy and with a lot of murder in our family history. And so I studied over the years in my own academic research, what happened to their pain because it didn't get processed. what happened when, like, you know, my grandmother lost her siblings and her parents to murder and then came to start over again. So I was really interested in where does our pain go when it's, you know, for those of us that are, you know, I was born into like a very easy, privileged childhood with like, but the house, you know, it's almost like the house was like, it was almost like poltergeisty, like a very beautiful house, sort of shaking at the edges a little bit with history. So I can explain more. It's like sort of a longer explanation. Maybe after the break, I will explain a little bit more about inherited trauma and what that looks like. But it's sort of just asking a formal question of, do we pass pain on culturally? Do we pass pain on in family patterns of violence? Do we pass pain on through different systems of thought? And looking at where are we passing pain? Where are we holding pain for other people that wasn't ours, but now is our own? And looking at that sort of inherited legacies of pain. And New Orleans has a lot of inherited legacies of pain.
Well, you know, that's really what you're saying is, you know, makes total sense to me. I never heard it in that way, particularly, you know, as a city or, you know, a town that you're saying New Orleans has that inherited place. And I think probably many others as well. So in your book, you talk about dealing with your passing of your father, or and not just the passing, but seeing him as he was just at the end of his life. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And, obviously, it's pretty, it's traumatic, and it's difficult to deal with. And I think what I found in reading what I read so far was that sometimes when you read something like this, it can hit you all different kinds of ways. But what I found in reading it, it's almost like it was like a practical guide on how to deal with trauma and grief, like different things you can do, different things that you might feel, different things that come up, and how to deal with them. And it's interesting because a really good friend of mine just called me about his son who's having some difficulty in his life, who's, you know, 28 years old. But at any age, we can deal, we might have something that we have to deal with, such as death or some kind of trauma. So my question is, for anyone who writes a book, what led you to writing a book on, and also where the title come from? I love the title because it's like, you know, eat cake, you know, forget prayers, bring cake. You know, you're Jewish, right? And that's the first thing I thought, is she a Jewish woman before? Because I don't know, it's always about eating something to make you feel good, which is we need to eat. But tell me a little bit about the title and what made you, what got you into writing the book?
Sure. The title, Forget Prayers, Bring Cake, was sort of a tongue-in-cheek, just like frustration in the midst of my grief. You know, as my father was dying, there was a need for certain, like, tangible care. And people were praying for me, and I was so grateful for prayer. And also at times it felt imposing when it wasn't a prayer tradition that I shared. Or sometimes people were coming real close to my dad's soul in certain ways, like praying for just all kinds of like things that I was curious about boundaries. And, you know, do my new thing is asking, you know, I love to pray. The irony of the book is I'm a very prayerful person, and it's a daily part of my life. And I love prayer, like, deeply, truly. But I'm noticing that it's important to have boundaries with prayer and to ask, like, are you comfortable with prayer? And the bring cake part was basically that there was, I mean, the book title just came from my experience in my grief, but the book itself came from me realizing that when I was home with my two siblings, that I was processing the experience really differently, partially because of who I am and partially because I didn't have someone else constantly living with me and checking in on me and, like, holding me through it. I was sourcing my grief differently. And I think the prayers part for me was like, what will reach me right now in my isolation? And sometimes the prayer was really nice, but what I felt I really needed was somebody to put their love into an act that was tangible and come towards me with it. And that's what the cake, I mean, it was supposed to be funny, which I think it is. And it's also emblematic of what I think single women need, which is visible, tangible care from their people that love them when they aren't getting touch and they're not getting, some single women are getting plenty of touch, but the ones that aren't having a consistent partner or a consistent roommate even acts like bringing a cake might resonate just so much more loudly. And so that was sort of the inception of this book was, can I make it easier for other women going through what I'm going through? Can I give them the book I wish I had?
I see.
I wrote it.
Do you think the book is, as you were writing the book and you just said for women need the touch, you think it's more for women or is it could be for anyone?
I mean, the treatise of the book is for women, but the book could be read by anyone. I mean, you have to be strong to read a book that's directed at women and this book is for everybody. Mm-hmm. And I think there are some men that wouldn't be able to handle that the message is towards a woman. I have no idea. Who knows? But the women that I've found have been most touched by this book are actually elder married women. And it's because it's my story. It's not necessarily here's what you should do as much as here's what I went through. But a lot of people are really telling me that it's useful and retroactively revisiting old grief and revisiting how they dealt with it and giving themselves like almost a new life, a new love in this time. Because the book tells my story of what it felt like for me moving to New Orleans and losing my father and navigating, like I was sort of like wrangling my friends far and near because I was in the house by myself and knew that too much of that was going to probably make me, you know, now it's an interesting book because I was going to say it's going to make me go crazy. But I have so many women friends who lost parents during the pandemic who lived alone and went through it alone. And so the book, yeah, I mean, it's a relevant thing. Like, what does it mean to live alone and grieve? And what does it mean when you already feel like you're a problem and you need more and more help to feel loved and to be loved and sort of like a proclamation of like, you deserve it. But the book is organized in such a way that it's the timeline goes according to what happened to me. And then it's interspersed with advice to people along the way of, okay, here's what I learned in that lesson. Here's what I can offer you. And some of it's like organized for the griever who can't read. I mean, a lot of women and men and whoever, like forget the gender binary also, like non-binary people who are reading this book or reading any book after death, there's this element of the inability to focus altogether. And I'm sure everyone knows that moment in life, maybe all the time, where it's really hard to focus on a full narrative. So I really wanted it to have a table of contents where if you can't read the whole book, but you really need an after death checklist, like what to do when someone dies, who do I call? What do I need to do legally? That's in the book so that you can just flip to that page and have it rather than read the whole thing if your attention span is shorter.
Yeah, that's what I was right before the show started. I was talking to you about the fact that I love the outline of the book of how you have it all laid out because, when I looked at it, not reading the whole book, when I looked at all the different contents and I said, wow, that's pretty cool to, you know, go to page one, whatever, and see what to do about this. I think it's something that, frankly, I think it's, you know, I know you mentioned women is for everyone. And I really do think it's for everyone because, sometimes, I live alone right now, right? And I'm seeing someone and I do want to, we talked about living together. I'm divorced now eight years living alone. And, you know, we talk about living together, but she's not ready at this point. And mm-hmm. A good friend of mine said, well, why do you need to live together? And I said, well, because I would like to. I'd like to share my life with someone. And I don't want, you know, as opposed to being like, you know, seeing someone just on a weekend or three nights, but really share a place together because there's a big difference. But this friend of mine actually has not ever had a really long commitment with anyone, even though he was married, but it lasted only 4 years. And I find it, some people say I'm very sensitive and I think I am. Mm-hmm. And had to deal with a lot of grief with my own family and dealing with death and at a younger age. And I think it brings you you know, closer to a sense of reality about life that other people might not be dealing with until later. But then there's all kinds of trauma and grief that people deal with. It's not, you know, we were talking about that the other day about dealing with trauma, people who have been through wars and lost their loved ones, or, you know, and now with COVID and people have lost loved ones. So it's a fact of life. We don't live forever, and what happens after. And well, you said something really interesting that I want to touch on is that boundaries, that sometimes people cross boundaries when they're trying to help, but maybe through their prayers. But I'll tell you one, you might think this is pretty interesting for me. It was when my father was dying, and he had suffered a lot in his life. And it was clear that he was on his deathbed. From talking to many doctors, I was in charge in my family to talk to the doctors, and we switched him to another hospital and all this stuff. And I ended up getting married in the hospital because they thought he was going to go that in the next day or so. And it turned out he lived another year and a half or 2 years. And I really felt that getting married there, not by his bedside, they wouldn't let that because they thought it would be too much, but in the chapel in the hospital, Mount Sinai Hospital in Miami. And we transferred him that day to the hospital from another one because the main doctor, I said, what would you do if it was your father? And he said, I would get him to another hospital, Mount Sinai. Long story short, we got married. He lived for another year and a half, 2 years. And I really felt it made a difference. And when he passed on, it was clear that this was going to be the end. And I'll get to this real quick. We have a commercial coming up. This rabbi came to me and said, I looked in his eyes, and this is like maybe he passed on 2 days later. And he said, I know he's going to live. I know he's going to live. He's going to make it through. And there, you know, at that point, I was like, go away. Don't. You know, it's nice that you're here and you're giving your wishes and your prayers, but don't tell me, you know, I didn't say that. I just looked at him thinking it was arrogant. It was like he was a prophet and he knew. It really bothered me. And I really feel when you say cross boundaries, he crossed boundaries right there.
Yeah. Well, that's the other thing is I think a lot of us don't even know what a boundary is. Yeah. And that's part of the issue. And theologically, I often would say things to friends like, I think your father is here in the room. I feel him with us. I know he's proud of you. And now that my own father's dead, I don't say those things anymore because they presume a shared understanding of the divine. And many of us just don't have that, or a shared understanding of the afterlife. Like a lot of people, and it's confusing because sometimes I love it. Like if the right person is connected enough and says to me, oh, I know your father's really proud of you right now. It kind of feels good sometimes, but most of the time it feels like, how the heck do you know if my dad's here?
Right.
It's a question of, I think like what I like to practice now is like, would you be comfortable if I share what, you know, how like this thought about that's sort of like a supernatural, but right. People love to say that.
I just need to stop you for 1 minute because we have to go to a break.
Yeah.
Kind of missed it there, but. So we're going to go to a break right now, and we'll continue with Marissa when we get right back. Thank you.
Howdy, I am Joseph Franklin McElroy, host of the new podcast, Gateway to the Smokies. It airs on talkradio.nyc every Tuesday night from 6 p.m. to 7. Every episode is dedicated to memorable experiences in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park and surrounding areas. This show features experts and locals who will expound upon the richness of culture, history, and adventure that awaits you in the Smokies. Tune in every Tuesday from 6 p.m. to 7 on talkradio.nyc.
Are you a cannabis enthusiast, a cannabis professional, or interested in entering the cannabis space? I'm Johnny Tsunami, and this is Planet Baco Lolo, a less taboo view. On our show, we will discuss the cannabis world through the perspective of various cannabis professionals. Tune in every Thursday evening, Eastern Standard Time, 6 p.m., Talk Radio NYC, Planet Paco Lolo, a less taboo view.
Are you passionate about the conversation around racism? Hi, I'm Reverend Dr. TLC, host of the Dismantle Racism Show, which airs every Thursday at 11 a.m. Eastern on talkradio.nyc. Join me and my amazing guests as we discuss ways to uncover, dismantle, and eradicate racism. That's Thursdays at 11 o'clock a.m. on talkradio.nyc.
Are you a small business trying to navigate the COVID-19 related employment laws? Hello, I'm Eric Sauver, employment law business law attorney and host of the new radio show, Employment Law Today. On my show, we'll have guests to discuss the common employment law challenges business owners are facing during these trying times. Tune in on Tuesday evenings from 5 p.m. to 6 p.m. Eastern Time on talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC at www.talkradio.nyc. Now broadcasting 24 hours a day.
Hi, we're back with Marissa, and we've been talking about her book, Forget Prayers, Bring Cake. You were talking about, we were talking about boundaries when we left off.
Big topic. Yes, the first ones we were talking about were like spiritual boundaries. And I think it's one of the rules I have for when I visit a griever now that I've been, you know, I've grieved in my life many things, but I've never been the daughter of a dead dad, and like going through that experience, my thresholds are different. And I think what I love is to take the cues from the griever themselves. So I think in life, and it's weird because boundaries simply mean like ways in which we protect ourselves and others. And when we are grieving, I feel like so many rules, like social rules, die, and we stop doing things the way we're quote unquote supposed to. And I thought if it's helpful, I might just read to you from page 109 of this book, where there's actually a two-page sort of spread on setting your own boundaries. And it says, what is a boundary? According to educator, activist, and researcher Mackenzie Mack, boundary work is the practice of acting on our right to decide when and how our physical, mental, and emotional capacity will be used and for what purpose. So it's saying like we'd make that decision. It says, and then I say, this is no longer a quote, this is more than just saying no or refusing to do things that make us profoundly uncomfortable when already living in a state of discomfort. It is an act of protecting sacred inner space, of making choices and speaking limits out loud, of allowing room within us to go through the work of grief and mourning. And I think like socioculturally, we all have boundaries in place. Like I'm from Washington, D.C., from a sort of affluent part of the city where lots of unspoken boundaries are a part of our lexicon. But grief sort of, because so many parts of our sort of defense system get broken down when we're in an extreme state of pain and loss, it's really important to be able to say what you need and to set sort of the limits of the room so that you don't. I think my goal also in this particular chapter was like, don't yell at your friends. Don't yell at your family. How can you get to that point? And I know myself and many others got into like a lot of yelling when they were grieving, and how to mitigate that. And so one of the ways is to start to sort of verbally articulate limits. And I wrote, why do boundaries matter more in times of grief? We are vulnerable when we grieve, tender in new ways. Parts of us we spent years shielding and protecting and refusing to touch might suddenly be raw and exposed. This is a time that warrants protecting, and also a time that likely demands so much strength and hard work in new ways. This hard work also deserves to be honored and protected and given ample space. Don't wait for someone else to protect you. You are the protector now. Setting boundaries is really about stating needs and being honest with ourselves about where we are in this moment and how that changes over time. It also includes saying no, learning how to say, I can't be there for you, and know what to expect when someone hates you for it. Saying no and pulling inwards, as long as the risk is not too great, is encouraged. Things like that. So it's like asking for help. And then preparing. This chapter also talks about a lot of, I'm sure everyone's had that moment where you say, hey, I can't, you know, that's beyond my comfort zone, or I can't do that. And someone's so mad at you very, very quickly, because they think it's about not loving them rather than it being about you. Like tonight, I'm supposed to meet a friend and we're going to an outdoor event at like 7:15. She said, can I come to your house? And then we'll go over together. And I realized the answer is tonight. The answer for me is no, I'd rather meet you there. Because I need a little space after I do, you know, I just taught at Tulane all day and then a radio interview. I'll need some personal space to just reset myself for a human company. But I can tell she's mad. She doesn't like that. She doesn't like that I drew that I drew the curtains on what her request was. And that's something that I want people to like prepare themselves for, that people might get mad at you. It says people will often retaliate when you set limits to protect yourself. Saying no to things we used to always say yes to will shock a lot of people, and it will make people who don't understand the depth of your experience angry. Know their rage is more often than not about their own weird issues, and it's not your problem. They probably feel rejected by you, and hopefully that praise, this is as a praise, you're supposed to say like, I did this, like, I would love to be with you. I can't. And then say, I can't wait to see you later, to give them this like praise sandwich to mitigate that sort of rejection. You want to be aware that everyone always feels rejected, so you don't want to make them feel that way. And there's like ways to set boundaries that, you know, I could have just texted her no, and I made it really clear what was going on. So, and then also calibrate when the reactions of others really don't meet the gravity of the moment and step away. So there will be times when you say no and someone just starts screaming at you. And if you know that you didn't do very much, then you can walk away. It's not yours to take care of their yelling. And it's really, really hard. And boundaries are about caring, not fighting, to remind you that you are worthy of these limits set to protect, guard, and grow the best parts of you. You could buy, so there's like, this is just reminding you to care for yourself and set boundaries, but it's hard work. I mean, I think when we're grieving, we're stepping outside of traditional society. I mean, our society doesn't build a lot of room for grief. So we're stepping outside of normative behavior, and that requires a little bit of like careful protecting, because some people are going to pop, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, some of the things that you just talked about, I think don't even, are not just when you're grieving. I mean, it seems like some of the things you're saying are just, you know, everyday behavior can be like, you know, when are you stepping on someone's toes, how to say no to someone without hurting their feelings. You know, like in a relationship, for instance, you know, learning to be in a relationship with someone and understanding them, what their needs are and your own needs. And, it, you know, that they're being upset about something you say could take you totally by surprise, because you don't know how sensitive they are to what the subject is of whatever you're talking about. It might be much greater to them than it is to you. And especially, you know, male, female differences that come up, and, you know, whatever they could be. But I think, you know, like what made me think just now when you said about boundaries and kind of like knowing what to say at times, it makes me think about, I've grown up in a very small knit community, a Syrian Jewish community in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. And when you get to know a lot of people and have a lot of relatives, there's a lot of people that pass on, and sitting Shiva is a whole custom, and you go to the house, and really from place to place, you don't know what to expect. Right. You go to someone who's, they're grieving, but when you get to that house, and there could be a lot of people there or not many, but it's very open and friendly and sweet. And people sometimes are laughing and all that, because sometimes they're talking about, you know, the way that person was and the good times that they had. It all depends on that particular family, that, you know, how that person passed away. Was it a sudden death, which is sometimes obviously, you know, much sadder than someone, but it's still sad. But you have to, it's like you say, you have to gear the room, gear who you're talking to, you know, figure it out.
Yeah.
Like I recently went to my my best friend's house. They were sitting Shiva, and his father was one day away from being 101 years old. So he lived a really good life and a long life, and most people don't live that long. And it was a really sweet time to be there to just, you know, I knew his father. He was a funny guy. He always made fun of everybody. And that was what a lot of the conversation was. And he was a giving guy. So a lot depends on the situation, who that person was. But it sounds to me like you've really put this book together and in all the sections of trauma and, you know, questions that come up later, what to do. Maybe talk a little bit more about that, you know, some of the sections that you have, like I think you say, you know, what to do afterwards. What are some of the practical things you
do? So the table of contents is divided into three parts. Life before death, life after death. And then life before death, life after death. And then part three is the future. And so in life before death, we have identifying your needs, setting up your grief support, special requests, how to even ask for help, dating standards when you're grieving, building an after death checklist, and understanding trauma. And this was really just like wandering through. I was just thinking about what I thought I needed and what I was Googling when my dad was dying. And I really wanted to explain carefully like my symptoms of grief, because my symptoms were so weird. And I was also traumatized by witnessing the death, and I had all these things going through me. And then I asked other people what was happening to their bodies. And this was something I couldn't figure out on, like, you write a book when it can't be Googled, right? Like the thing you can't get the Google answer to. So I kept Googling, like, what do I, you know, why does my stomach hurt all the time? Or like, why is it normal that I don't want to get out of bed at all? And, you know, I could use WebMD and be like, okay, you have pancreatitis and you have like chronic fatigue and you're depressed. But really I was grieving. And what I was starting to learn, like, it would have been helpful if someone listed the symptoms for me. And I had a grief counselor who I just called her. I was like, yeah, all these weird body problems are happening all of a sudden. They didn't have a month ago. She's like, yeah, when the feelings you've got are stuck inside of you and they're showing up. And I wanted a book that would just make all that plain for someone else. So part two, life after death, setting new boundaries, relationships after loss, how to get a grief group and grief counselors, and then how to pray and what is prayer and why does it matter? How to stabilize your nervous system. This is looking at like hurricanes and racism and griefs that like compound one after the other. Like, what do you do if you're having a panic attack and you need to calm it down and you can't get to 911 fast enough? And then also looking at anniversaries, death anniversaries, going to the grave, how to build a ritual. What will you do each year or each memory? I mean, and what's the power of a ritual? Why is it useful? And I also look a lot at Jewish, like starting the second half of the book, I look a lot at my own, like sort of the inheritance of Jewish mourning rituals and how to deal with that, how to deal with wanting to honor them. And then also I couldn't, like, I didn't write about this in the book, but COVID hit while I was mourning, and my dad died 3 months before COVID, and I couldn't go to Kaddish. And for those that don't know, Kaddish is like a daily prayer for the dead that I know my father wanted me to do. And there wasn't a daily minyan, which is like a 10-person prayer group. For the first 3 months, I just couldn't find one here in New Orleans that was my speed. There was Orthodox ones. And then after that, there wasn't daily anything. Like, I couldn't honor my Jewish rituals. And so part of what I wanted I really intentionally have not mentioned COVID once throughout the book. I want death to be about death, universal. Throughout the ages for this book. But I do know that during my mourning rituals, we couldn't meet in person. And so because I couldn't have group gatherings, we started to innovate. And I had to figure out, like, how do you give yourself permission to break your religious order in order to honor your religion? It's like a crazy sentence. But what do you do if you want to say Kaddish and there's no minyan? What do you do if you want to, you know, like, can you fake it? Is it allowed? Is God going to love you? And I wanted to empower people in those chapters to do it yourself and to feel like agency to, even if you're not a rabbi, to be the rabbi of your own life and to like take into account that this is your grief, this is your loss, and there's ways to do it. And then I end with how to be the grief support and just like some ideas about that. And I'll read to you a little bit from the introduction, if that's useful, to just like set the frame for the book.
Yeah, that would be great. Let's we're going to take another break.
Great.
We'll come back and Marissa will read a little bit more from the book. But I think what you have there is a really great guide, because what you're saying is just, you know, it's like, you know, like, what do you do if you're, you know, being Jewish, and if you need a minion, 10 people, and you don't have it, what do you do?
Right.
And I think a lot of that is, for me, sometimes you do, I would say for me, I would do what I feel I could do that would satisfy me, because I think in basically you want to honor your, let's say your father in this case, but you want to, it's also honoring yourself, I think. That,
yeah. But it's confusing when you've been taught that like there's one way.
Yes.
And so there, I was trying to empower people to like dissect the impact of Kaddish, dissect the ways in which that works, and reinvent it for yourself when you need to, because we do need to right now reinvent everything.
Yeah. All right. We'll be right back with Marissa talking about her book, Forget Prayers and Bring Cake. Thank you.
Hey, everybody, it's Tommy D, the nonprofit sector connector, coming at you from my attic. Each week here on talkradio.nyc, I host a program, Philanthropy in Focus. Nonprofits impact us each and every day, and it's my focus to help them amplify their message and tell their story. Listen each week at 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time until 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on talkradio.nyc.
Do you feel uninformed about menopause and how it impacts on your life? Hi, I'm Pat Duckworth, women's health strategist and host of the Hot Women Rock radio show, empowering women leaders at menopause. Join me every Thursday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, 3 p.m. UK time on talkradio.nyc for interviews with inspirational women who will share their top tips to rock your world.
Have you ever thought of reinventing yourself? Are you looking to create a new life's journey? Hi, I'm Kevin Barbaro, host of Coffee Talk XL every Tuesday night, 5, 8 p.m. Eastern on talkradio.nyc. Tune in live to hear me and my guests from a variety of different backgrounds. As a former college coach and a current full-time actor and owner of multiple companies, my show is as eclectic as my life. That's Coffee Talk XL every Tuesday night, 8 p.m. on talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC at www.talkradio.nyc. Now broadcasting 24 hours a day.
Hi, we're back with Marissa, and we've been talking about her book, Forget Prayers, Bring Cake. So we were talking about the rituals. So tell us some more about.
Sure. Yeah. So we were talking about, I mean, I guess what I wanted to read a little bit is about, just from the introduction, because I think the question I had also, sort of a theme in our talk today, has been religious boundaries. And one of the things that you were mentioning was like this sort of niche community you came from that was practicing Shiva, and every community has its own rituals. I mean, that's what's really mind-boggling. And also not like, I had an issue many years ago where a dear friend lost a family member, and they're from a different background, but everything she wanted me to participate in went directly against what I was taught to, and I had to figure out, so when do I use her communal boundaries? And when do I use my communal boundaries? And like, what does it look like to honor the dead for her versus for me? And I had to draw my own limits for myself, but also let some of them go to support her. So here, this is just from the introduction to the book. It says, we need to wail. We need to scream. And if we can't, we need to find some way to siphon out the pain, because grief is everywhere. It is in our coffee, poured by those who have suffered recent losses. It is on the news and in the subtext of our friends' Instagram feeds. Grief is as ever present as sexuality, and it too requires a release, an orgasm from mourning, a pouring out of that which is contained in the body, ignored and not attended to. We are, as a culture, chronically grief ridden. The question is how to grieve, how to feel, how to mourn without blasting to smithereens. Most of us don't have a script that allows us to release our grief like the one my friend was taught in an anecdote that starts the book. And even if we do, we often cannot honor it within new cultural milieus, living within systems of social codes that preclude us from our origin practices. So many of us were never taught how to grieve, who to speak to, what to do, or when to quit. Sure, the Bible says to sow in tears and reap in gladness, but whose priest or guru or rabbi sat them down and slowly explained what grief is, why it must be honored, and how to grieve? Not mine. This book, I'm just fast forwarding because I don't want to read all of it, but I want to get you the stuff that matters with this conversation. This book posits the idea that grief is not to be recovered from, but rather prepared for. It is not predictable in linear stages, but rather a wild storm to ride out, to learn to navigate individually before the next and the next grief arrives. Grief is a fact of life. And I, I had this question of, it says up here, with no model and no clear set of instructions as how to move through the treacheries of loss, I had questions. What does it mean to mourn properly? How much grief is too much grief? What if you call on your friends and they can't be there? What is allowed and who decides what is allowed? If we are not all following one set of rules, what is appropriate? Is there a wrong way to grieve? And so I was just asking these questions, and what I wanted was for people to have ways in which that they could honor themselves no matter what's coming. Like I realized, and I'm still, you know, I'm watching my parents, you know, get into their mid and late 70s. It was like, as often as I went to weddings in my 20s, they were going to funerals. And it was like that much death. And I realized like we should be less afraid of this thing that we have to deal with. And the only way to be less afraid is to be more prepared. Like we need more tools ready to go so that when the death does come, we will always be hurt by it, but we will be able to navigate that storm a little bit better.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it makes a lot of sense because there's, this is a really good handbook, I feel. I mean, the word handbook may sound like, but it really is. Like, it's a good handbook on how to deal with grief and trauma and loss and how to take rituals. And I think it's how do you take a ritual and make it your own ritual? Like, yes. Because you can't be really sincere if you're not really believing in the ritual that you're following.
Right.
Because you might not agree with it or it just doesn't feel right for you. Like, and it's like, really being yourself. And then again, you know, at times we don't know how we're going to react in certain situations because it's a new situation for us.
Yeah.
So when the situation arrives again, maybe, or something similar, we have that experience on how to deal with it. Mm-hmm.
How to find personal power. I think that what you were saying, like a lot of people in religious contexts do just go along with the motions and do feel dead inside and don't necessarily believe in diddly. And for some, that's really comforting. But I think the times that we are currently in, the world has always been broken, but we are in this country in particular, we're suddenly realizing that all the comfort we thought was eternal. If many of us, many of people listening have always been uncomfortable, but many people who have built like the illusion of ease and not being harmed by the world's ailments, now is really the time to start to take agency into one's hands and say, okay, what can I do to make this moment profound? What can I do to make this moment sacred? And I think when you feel out of control, which we all do right now, I don't think there's a single person who feels totally in control right now. I mean, at least where I live, we're all in this very confused existential crisis where we just had a very clear vision of what it will look like when we have to get out of here and we might not be able to come back. Like, we had to leave for 2 weeks. New Orleans was in a 2 week coma for, you know, there was no 911 for part of that time. There was no streetlights. There was no trash pickup. There were no restaurants. There was the electricity tower falling into the Mississippi River. So when you come back from that, like, we all have a choice right now. Like, we all wander around like rattled, nervous wrecks, and like, and that's it. Or we take some power to make our own meaning and the day to day. And that sounds so cheesy, but it's not really. Like, sure, I was taught to go to Kaddish, and I always think of the scene in Curb Your Enthusiasm when they're walking in the Lower East Side and this baseball player is like called in, and, you know, there's all kinds of like traditional ways of honoring the dead. But right now, we get to make, you know, you get to invent the wheel. You get to go do a dance in the street if that's what you need to do, which is what we do down here in New Orleans. But if in Brooklyn or in like the middle of in the middle of Midtown, you want to go honor your dead in some new way, like, why not come alive in this moment where we're all struggling with finding a way to reinvent what it means to be human when the world around us is shifting so rapidly? And I mean, it's just so important. The other thing is, like, the book is Forget Prayers, Bring Cake, A Single Woman's Guide to Grieving. And the reason, it's not just Forget Prayers, Bring Cake. Like, the title was invented in DC when I was at home and mad that like two cakes were brought for my sister and my father. No one brought me a cake. And I was like, come on. But now that I'm in New Orleans, like, cake is really integral to this place. And king cake, if you don't know what king cake is, it's like a Mardi Gras tradition. And there are just so many here. And the book ends with me sort of doing like a, almost like a litany of king cakes. And cake, I've learned since living in New Orleans, is historic here. Like, it's not just king cake, it's d'auberge cake. It's like, there's an apple cake that there's like the ancient Jewish communities here had. And like, cake is a big deal, but cake also represents like coming together for birth and like coming together for joy and coming together for life. And I think part of what I was saying was, hey, don't forget, like, don't forget, even though you've just gone through the death of someone, that you are here. There's like people here. There's like, don't give, you know, there's so much to be done and so many people to love right now. And it doesn't have to be romantic. Like, give some people some cake. Like, I yesterday went to, there's a woman in New Orleans who has an incredible bakery called Bayou St. Cake. She's in a lot of people during the pandemic in New Orleans. It's very weird. Like, if you went to a restaurant and ate outside, they would never have bread here. And it's not because of gluten. It's because no one was baking in the restaurants anymore. They made their own autonomous bakeries. And Bayou St. Cake is one of these incredible local artisans. And she yesterday was selling cake at the farmer's market, which she doesn't, she was trying something new. And she made a huge sheet cake and she cut it in slices. I will tell you, it was a religious experience just eating her carrot cake. And I got that cake and I bought 5 slices and I've been distributing it to people across the city. Everyone is sad right now. Like, they just, everyone is sad. Everyone's roof fell in, or everyone went through a divorce, or everyone has a relative with COVID, or they're scared of COVID, or somebody in their neighborhood died of it. And every, but God, giving someone cake is really nice.
Really, Marissa, I love what you have to say. We're going to have to stop because you're such a passionate person and I love talking with you and hearing it's getting me hungry. But I get what you're saying. I think it's really important. So everyone, just tell us how people can get the book real quickly.
You can get it anywhere. You can get it online on Amazon if that's your speed. You can get it at your local bookstore. It's available across the board. You can get it at Target. You can get it anywhere.
Okay.
So just go get it.
All right. Go get the book, Forget Prayers, Bring Cake by Marissa Gerson. And when you have a chance, watch Extra Innings. You can watch it on SimbaMovies.com or you can go on Amazon, and it's on 7 other platforms right now. Good night, Marissa. Thank you so much for being on the show. And everyone, have a good evening. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC. Uplift, educate, empower.
Do you run or are ready to open your own business? Hi, I'm Jeremiah Fox. I've been operating and opening small business for the last 25 years, and I'm the host of the new show, The Entrepreneurial Web. Tune in every Friday at noon Eastern Time for insights and stories on the nuances of running small business right here on Fridays at noon, talkradio.nyc.
Do you love or are you intrigued about New York City and its neighborhoods? I'm Jeff Goodman, host of Rediscovering New York, a weekly show that showcases New York's history and its extraordinary neighborhoods. Every Tuesday live at 7 p.m., we focus on a particular neighborhood and explore its history, its vibe, its feel, and its energy. Tune in live every Tuesday at 7 p.m. on talkradio.nyc.
Did you know that nearly one in five adults in the U.S. battles mental illness? Hi, my name is Albert Dabba. I'm the host of the show Extra Innings. Extra Innings, I discuss the topics of wellness, mental health, and the experience of surviving multiple suicides within my family. Listen live every Monday at 6 p.m. Eastern to Extra Innings for discussions with sports figures, artists, mental health professionals, and many others. That's Monday at 6 p.m. Eastern on talkradio.nyc.
In a post-COVID world, you may have many unanswered questions regarding your health. Are you looking to live a healthier lifestyle? Do you have a desire to learn more about mental health and enhance your quality of life? Or do you just want to participate in self-understanding and awareness? I'm Frank R. Harrison, host of Frank About Health, and each Thursday, I will tackle these questions and work to enlighten you. Tune in every Thursday at 5 p.m. on talkradio.nyc, and I will be Frank About Health to advocate for all of us.
Host of the new podcast, Gateway to the Smokies. It airs on talkradio.nyc every Tuesday night from 6 p.m. to 7. Every episode is dedicated to memorable experiences in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park and surrounding areas. This show features experts and locals who will expound upon the richness of culture, history, and adventure that awaits you in the Smokies. Tune in every Tuesday from 6 p.m. to 7 on talkradio.nyc.